You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Are Africa's oil reserves a blessing disguised as a curse or a curse disguised as a blessing? John Gasvinian considered that and other questions during a recent visit to 12 oil-rich African countries, and he concluded that discovery of oil has resulted in harming rather than helping the economy of every country he investigated. He writes about his discoveries in Untapped from Harcourt. The Boston Globe called it a riveting account full of superb analysis, and I'm very pleased it has brought John Gasvinian to my show today. Hello.
Thank you for having me.
How much of the world's oil is now thought to be located in Africa?
Well, it's very difficult to really pinpoint reserves, but it's probably about 10% of the world's oil, which is a deceptive figure, actually. It's not a new Middle East, but it is a very important region. This is a very good, high-quality crude. It's very easy to transport. It has a lot of advantages that make it very important for the oil industry. And it's a rapidly growing oil province. It's the hottest destination for the oil industry globally right now.
Because in oil also can be refined more easily from some sources than others. And we've heard for years that Nigeria had a particularly good oil, more easily refined, purer.
That's right. The oil along the west coast of Africa is a light, sweet crude. It's the oil man's oil. It's basically cheap and easy to refine when it gets to the United States or to European refineries that have high environmental standards. It's also very easy to transport. You just put it on a boat and take it to America. You don't have to build a pipeline or a canal or anything like that.
Are the dozen countries you visited known to have the major part of Africa's oil reserves?
Yeah, the key thing to realize is that we're actually getting as much oil now from Africa as we are from Saudi Arabia. In fact, in February and March, we got more oil just from Nigeria than we did from Saudi Arabia. So it's something that is very rapidly becoming an important part of America's energy portfolio.
How difficult was it logistically for you to travel to some of these countries? I mean, I know you had a pretty hard time getting into Sudan, didn't you?
Yeah, it really depends on the. Well, the thing about Sudan, I was in South Sudan, which is still is not administered by the Sudanese government, but rather by the rebel movement, the Sudan People's Liberation Army. So you have to get a special permit. Some of these countries are easier to operate in than others. Nigeria is a place that sees a lot of journalists. There are other countries that don't, and there is even one or two countries that don't really want journalists. I was asked to leave one country as well. So it depends.
Were people more willing to speak to you because you're of Iranian ancestry?
I think you'd have to ask them.
Uh-huh. But I mean, you didn't look like your standard Westerner.
Yeah, there's a lot of Lebanese, traders and so on in Africa. So people are used to people who look different.
You've said that the current scramble for African oil is reminiscent of the colonial scramble for Africa that took place in the 19th century. In what ways?
Yeah, I wouldn't want to push that too far, but I do suggest that this is sort of a new scramble for Africa. It's not exactly the same thing as colonialism, but you do have basically people from all over the world that are very excited about African oil. The Chinese, the Americans, the Europeans, the Brazilians, the Australians, Malaysians, Indians, you name it. Everybody's in there. It's a vast, unexplored territory for the oil industry, and there's no one who isn't scrambling for a little piece of the action, basically.
But, of course, China is a newcomer to this. Is it as big a player in African oil as newspaper stories would lead us to believe?
Yes, if not bigger. China's a huge part of this story. China gets 30% of its imports from Africa, we get about 15 to 18%. We're expected to get about 25% in the next few years. So that competition dynamic is already starting to build.
How much of the increase in the world's interest in Africa's oil can be attributed to major advances in underwater drilling technology?
That's also a big part of the story. For many years, Western, especially American oil companies, avoided Africa because it was seen as a sort of volatile place to operate. Which it certainly is, yes, for all the obvious reasons. It's just they don't have that luxury anymore in many ways. The world, as we know, is sort of beginning to run out of oil, and with the price of oil being as high as it is, Africa becomes attractive suddenly. Now, the technology you're talking about is deep water offshore drilling that we couldn't do 20 years ago. you know, we just didn't have the technology. Nowadays, we have drills that go several miles below the below sea level.
And it also takes the oil rigs away from the people who might be upset by their presence.
Exactly. And anyone who knows Nigeria understands why this is important. Basically, so much of the new oil that's coming in from Africa is ultra-deep water, or deep water, which is often 100 miles out to sea, which is great from the perspective of an oil company, because they don't have to deal with angry villagers and so on, and people kidnapping their employees or hijacking their installations, as happens in Nigeria.
And as you said, it also eliminates pipelines, because they can just transfer the oil directly to ships from these offshore rigs.
Exactly, onto sort of floating production vessels, which then collect the oil and just stick it straight onto barges and bring it over to us. It's a cheap, easy way of doing business.
Can they be seen from the shore?
You can see the rigs if they're nearby. You can't see the floating production, storage and offloading vessels. Those are quite a long way out.
And were you able to visit any of the offshore rigs?
No, some of the oil companies I worked with were quite cooperative, but that's quite a lot to ask, and that was not an opportunity made available.
My guest is John Gasvinian. His book, Untapped, The Scramble for Africa's Oil, is published by Harcourt. And you've written that Africa's oil boom has produced more jobs in the United States and Europe than it has in Africa. What percentage of people working these offshore oil rigs are hired from local areas?
Virtually no one. This is one of many great tragedies of this story, is that oil exploration, especially offshore oil exploration, is a capital intensive and sort of skills intensive industry. It doesn't require a lot of local unskilled labor. Basically, you fly in engineers and multi-million dollar equipment from around the world. The locals don't even realize what's really happening, except that they're not really seeing any benefit from it.
It doesn't get spread around because this whole thing is what is called an enclave industry.
Yeah, that's one way to describe it. The oil company turns up, says to an impoverished, struggling African government, you have a lot of oil. You're clearly not in a position to exploit it yourself. We can do it, but we first have to recoup all of our costs from any profits we make, and what's left over, you can have 25% of the profits. And most African countries have been happy to sign them on the dotted line.
Well, since 1990, petroleum companies have spent $20 billion on oil exploration and production in Africa. They're expected to spend another $50 billion by 2010, and yet, instead of improving living conditions, that money seems to increase political and military instability and spur economic degradation. It's what's led a South American oil minister to call oil the devil's excrement, although that's in an oil-rich country that is pretty much, the Venezuela, which is pretty much living off of oil these days.
Yeah, a lot of people now talk about the curse of oil or the paradox of plenty. It's one of these things. It's counterintuitive. You think, we know so much about the problems of Africa, and we think, billions of dollars in oil money turning up would be a good thing. Could really eradicate a lot of poverty, take care of a lot of problems, but actually it's done anything but. And in fact, the African countries that are doing relatively well are the ones that are not oil rich.
The studies indicate, according to the ones that you reveal here, that the African countries without oil saw their economies grow four times faster than the ones with oil. And you've suggested that an economic mechanism that's become known as the Dutch disease is at least partly responsible.
Exactly.
What's a Dutch disease?
Yeah, this is complicated, but basically it's currency appreciation. What happens is you get large amounts of oil money coming in, and the country's national currency appreciates artificially, and the economy doesn't diversify the way it's supposed to, and you become a country that's overly reliant on imports, and then the oil starts to run out, and you're in big trouble.
And that happened in the Netherlands with natural gas
'60s. In the 60s and 70s, yes, exactly.
I didn't know.
Yeah, exactly. It was the Economist magazine that first called it the Dutch disease, but we see it all over Africa now. I mean, it's only the beginning, though. I mean, as I try to talk about in the book, oil has also created sort of an exacerbated conflicts, as in Nigeria or Congo Brazzaville. It puts people at each other's throats, basically, and it's not rocket science. You take a poor, struggling African country with a lot of ethnic conflict and pre-existing difficulties and not a lot of capacity, and you introduce billions and billions of dollars in oil money, and it's no surprise that that's not going to be a happy story.
Well, you cite Gabon as a perfect example. You saw evidence of the problem when you visited a Gabon supermarket and couldn't buy a banana, although bananas seemed to be growing everywhere.
Gabon is actually one of the relative success stories, but ironically, yeah, as you say, this is a classic Dutch disease, you know, rentier state, where basically, you know, more than 60% of its food comes from abroad. You know, you can't even, they actually import their bananas from Cameroon next door, because no one can really be bothered to pick bananas. That's what's happened to the economy. That's what oil does, basically.
Also, there's been a huge influx of foreign currency, and so they have the money to spend on imports.
Exactly, and that destroys traditional agriculture and traditional industry, and the government doesn't invest in that. Instead, it builds, you know, grandiose projects and so on. And that's all fine and good, as long as A, the price of oil is high, and B, the oil doesn't run out. But neither of those is ever guaranteed in this business.
But it also creates inflation with the local currency, doesn't it?
Exactly, yeah. That's the Dutch disease.
So the things, the local food products become expensive relative to the imported items. It's actually cheaper to get those bananas from Cameroon.
Exactly.
So and once people stop buying local products, farmers and small merchants close their businesses and move to the cities to seek their fortunes, and the agricultural economy collapses. So city residents need to depend more and more on imported food.
Exactly. I mean, that is the Dutch disease in sort of in a nutshell. And Gabon is seeing that problem now. But so has Nigeria, so has a number of other African countries.
Well, so what happens when the oil supply runs out? Aren't countries like Gabon left without farming or light industry? And then what happens?
Big trouble. Big, big trouble. And that's beginning to happen in Gabon, where the oil is now beginning to run out. Already they're starting to have to really struggle to find new ways to you know, promote traditional industry and agriculture.
You compare Gabon to someone who's won the lottery and then gone on a wild binge, and then it has to wake up with a terrible hangover.
You go to Gabon, it's extraordinary. You see these magnificent government buildings, you know, the multi-million dollar fantastic modern train that runs into the jungle and no one actually uses. I mean, this is what happens. You get these, you know, a flood of money, and you have to be seen to be doing something with it.
So are we seeing Gabon already in decline? Is the oil running out?
It's beginning to, yeah. Although the Chinese have been, you know, reviving some of their sort of marginal and declining fields, which is another big part of this interesting story, actually, is that, you know, places that we've written off traditionally, the Chinese are quite happy to go in and do business with.
My guest is John Gazvinian, Ghazvinian, who's written for Newsweek, The Nation, Time Out New York, and other publications, and now has a book called Untapped, The Scramble for Africa's Oil. It's published by Harcourt. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with John Gazvinian. His book, Untapped, The Scramble for Africa's Oil, is published by Harcourt. How much of a factor is corruption in this equation? For example, Gabon's neighbor to the north, Equatorial Guinea, is that a good example of corruption exacerbating Dutch disease?
Equatorial Guinea is a country that's had a lot of problems even before the oil. This is a brutal, corrupt dictatorship. But the oil has only made life worse. This is really just a family business masquerading as a country, to be honest. It's $700 million of oil money that's parked in an offshore account in Equatorial Guinea, in a bank in Washington. Corruption is a big part of this story, whether it's Nigeria or anywhere else. You know, a lot of times when you don't have the capacity or the transparency that you might have in a Western country, it's very easy for politicians to dip into the oil money.
And since so much money is coming in, there's such a temptation, it's hard to imagine somebody not doing it.
Exactly. It's human nature, to be honest. I mean, there are good, decent politicians in Africa, certainly, but, you know, of course, you know, it's not the good eggs we hear about. It's the fact that, you know, take Nigeria, for example. Their own anti-corruption czar estimates that $380 billion, with a B, has disappeared in oil money in the last 40 years. And that is an extraordinary amount of money by anyone's standards.
You've included a fascinating theory in your book, developed in the 1970s by Hussein Madavi, an Iranian economist, that helps explain why so many African countries have failed to turn the cash wealth that they have earned selling oil into meaningful development for their citizens. Can you explain how this theory of rentier states really works?
Yeah, the simple version is this. If you picture, you know, people you know who work hard for a living, and you picture people who you know who are basically landlords who own lots of buildings and live off the rent, countries are the same. There are some countries where economic activity is promoted and encouraged by the government, and then there are some countries that act as landlords. And offshore enclave economy, like oil drilling, offshore oil exploration, it tends to encourage a sort of rent-seeking mentality in a country. Basically, you have a country that doesn't have to do anything but sit back and collect money from exploration that is done by international oil companies like Exxon or whoever. And that destroys it. Everything about destroys the economy and the political kind of civil society of a country, basically. You suddenly have a government that doesn't care about tax revenue and so stops listening to its citizens because all its money is coming from oil exploration.
Well, where do they put that money? Why don't they just use more of it to improve their infrastructure and build schools and hospitals and the like?
Sometimes they try, but it's even when intentions are good, corruption becomes an issue. People dip into the money. Also, you know, if you're trying to encourage traditional industry or agriculture, often a really, really struggling African country doesn't have the absorption capacity for a sudden influx of $2 billion, for instance. I mean, what are you going to do? Give that to sort of goat farmers? I mean, what are they actually going to do with millions of dollars?
So they hire a lot of people to work for them, and the bureaucracy just builds and expands.
Exactly. This is the classic symptom of the rentier state, is you just get a lot of government jobs being created where people are just pushing papers because they want to be seen giving jobs to people, and that tends to just slow things down and gum up the system.
And also, many of these governments tend to become increasingly militarized.
Yeah, it's one very easy thing to spend money on is weapons. Plus, again, when you have a citizen, when you have a population that is not really listened to, they often become restive. There's no real civil society, and you have to maintain order.
So we have this statistic. Between 1974 and 1984, military spending in OPEC countries as a percentage of their total budget, 3 times that of developed countries and up to 10 times that of non-OPEC members.
That's right. I wouldn't want to say that oil is the only reason why there is conflict or sort of military footprints in Africa. But certainly in countries that are oil-rich, conflict has been rife. I take Congo-Brazzaville, a small country we never hear about, not to be confused with the Democratic Republic of Congo, where there was a civil war that killed 10,000 people, and it was essentially fought over access to oil money. This is a country that gets 90% of its foreign income from oil. So, you know, when people are fighting for power, they're fighting for access to oil money.
Doesn't it also become a problem when the population of a rentier state begins to see the wealth or income as a result of an accident, not as a result of hard work or something that they have brought about?
This is what economists refer to as the rentier mentality, that also is probably one of the most damaging aspects of all of this. You know, you have your average citizenry walking around seeing that suddenly some of their fellow citizens and government ministers and so on are driving around in limousines and splashing out on champagne and so on. At one point, Gabon was the world's biggest per capita importer of champagne, for example. And people suddenly start to think, well, why am I working my tail off when actually the big money is to be made by, you know, the right connections and knowing the right people, and somebody else is, you know, and the whole mentality of hard work and setting up businesses and entrepreneurship and so on just disappears overnight.
Similar things have occurred in states we normally don't associate with this, like Saudi Arabia. But Dubai seems to be the exception to the rule. Any idea of why?
Yeah, I mean, the comparison with some of the Gulf states is difficult to make because obviously it's a very different situation. Obviously, in African countries, you have, for example, Nigeria is a country of 200 ethnic groups. So you do have that also, that taking care of my own kind of mentality that you don't get in some of the Gulf states where the countries are often really very large extended families. So there isn't as much squabbling over oil wealth, let's say. And plus, also the sort of Gulf Arab states have really prodigious amounts of oil. I mean, the sheer quantities of money are so great that you haven't had time to notice some of the detrimental effects yet.
So Dubai is really small with a lot of money. It can actually afford to build these tall buildings and encourage business to come there and think about what life will be like after the oil is gone.
Yeah, and they've done a lot of things right. I mean, they've built an economy that thrives on other things as well, like such as tourism and ports and that sort of thing.
You've been talking about Nigeria, obviously, as one of the worst examples. It's Africa's leading oil producer,
has had a lot of political turmoil for many years. Did the political turmoil precede the discovery of oil? Was there oil being drilled before Nigeria was given independence?
Just a couple years before independence, Shell discovered oil in 1958. But in a sense, Nigeria's oil boom was born with Nigeria as an independent nation. It's a bit chicken and egg to see sort of which came first, but it's gone hand in hand, conflict and oil in Nigeria since the day the country was born.
Well, some people have said that Nigeria is a perfect example of a country where the revolutionary leaders are effective until they come to power. Tafawa Blewa, the first president, actually seemed to be a very effective revolutionary leader, but then corruption from the start. And the system is really hard to break.
It's extremely hard to break. I mean, Nigeria, at this point, it's a country I love, but it's a country I have very little hope for. It's a very, very difficult thing to turn around at this point. It's worth stressing, this is a very important country. It's 140 million people. You know, one out of every six Africans is Nigerian. This is a country that could be a real powerhouse in Africa and one in which the U.S. relies a lot for its Africa policy. We get a lot of our oil from there as well. This is the fifth largest supplier of oil to the United States and an OPEC member and so on. There's a lot at stake there, and there's a lot that needs to be done, but the situation is pretty dire. I just got back from Nigeria a few weeks ago, and the situation in the Niger Delta is worse than it's ever been. You've had 200 foreign oil workers kidnapped in the last year and a half.
Nine Chinese oil company employees were murdered there just this past April.
It just gets worse and worse.
And you describe what you saw as Stone Age squalor. Now, we're talking about Nigeria, the seventh largest producer of oil in the world.
This is it. You go to the Niger Delta, you have mud and straw villages, with no running water, electricity, or even roads where people have to paddle canoes around just to get around. And right next to them are these multi-million-dollar air-conditioned state-of-the-art facilities. You have thousands of miles of pipelines crisscrossing the delta. This has been going on for 40 years. And the people there have seen no benefit from the oil exploration. And in fact, have only seen their lives get worse. There's so much oil gets spilt in the delta. The equivalent of one Exxon Valdez, where that much oil is spilled in the delta every 12 months. And it's just the frustration has boiled over to the point where in the last 10, 15 years we've seen a rather violent insurgency now.
My guest is John Gazvinian, Ghazvinian. His book, Untapped, The Scramble for Africa's Oil, is published by Harcourt. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You did see evidence of construction projects that had been started with oil money. Why weren't they completed?
Nigeria has made several attempts to improve the lives of people in the delta. It's just a combination of corruption and incompetence, basically. Even the military government back in the 80s and 90s, had its own sort of short-lived attempts to improve things in the delta. I visited villages out in the mangrove swamps where you'd have three little jetties built, one by Shell, one by the military government, and one by the democratic government. None of them were really working. Every now and then what happens is a village starts to create problems for the oil company. They hijack a platform, or they steal some crude oil, or they attack kidnap some workers, and then suddenly they have to get thrown a bone. So they get some money, or they get a little school or clinic or something, and then it just kind of gets left. I visited a village where they had a little clinic that had been built by Chevron, but it was shut. They said they didn't have anyone there to teach. They didn't have any doctors.
So the sabotage actually works as a kind of like political blackmail.
Blackmail is exactly the word for it, but it's very short-term, unfortunately, and that's been the problem of the Delta. It's always been a very short-term mentality, throw a bit of money at the problem.
And as you mentioned earlier, Nigeria, unlike those other countries, has relied on pipelines to transport much of its oil. Hasn't pipeline vandalism become a serious problem there? People are dying as a result of it.
Yeah, we hear this every now and then. We hear 100, 150 people get killed when a pipeline blows up. And what we always see when the pipeline blows up is just these long lines of jerry cans all lined up outside the pipeline. And clearly, in the middle of the night, local villagers have been queuing up to steal a bit of oil out of the pipeline. Someone's managed to drill a hole into it and steal away the oil. This is a big problem for Nigeria, is what they call illegally bunkered crude oil. Basically hundred or couple hundred thousand barrels a day is getting, you know, disappears and gets sold on the black market, and the profits get used by kind of ethnic militias to buy weapons and so on. It's a really entrenched problem there.
Because as you learned, this is not just done by individuals who freelancers. They sometimes get help from the local police, from politicians, and even some oil company employees.
Yeah. I should stress that the Nigerian government's begun to get a little bit of a handle on this since I wrote the book, but it still is a problem. Yeah, I mean, it entrenched all the way at the highest levels of Nigerian political society, frankly. This kind of illegal bunkering racket, the stealing of crude oil. Literally, they just drill a hole in the pipeline, steal the crude oil, put it onto barges, sell it onto an Eastern European tanker that's parked offshore. And the money just gets, funneled off to buying AK-47s and rocket-propelled grenade launchers and so on. And then these get these gangs that hold politicians ransom. And then you see them kidnapping foreign workers and so on. This is a cycle.
You say also the theft of oil from pipelines has become so securely under the control of what you've called the bunkering mafiosi that ordinary people no longer steal oil, now just tend to steal gas from a separate pipeline.
It started out, all this stealing of crude oil started out as one of many kind of expressions of popular resentment and sort of frustration by local local communities.
And fairly recent, because in 1993 there were only 7 cases mm-hmm. of pipeline vandalism. In 2000 it was up to 600.
Yeah, this is something that really, the late 90s, early 2000s, people really started to discover this as a way to, in their eyes, claim what was already theirs. You know, basically the people of the Delta don't see any of the money from the oil, so they felt, look, this is resource control, and resource control begins here, so we're going to start stealing the oil and making some money off it, which on some level you can sympathize with. But it quickly, of course, like all these things, turned into a criminal activity, and it fell into the hands of very organized gangs. And as I say, even very high-level Nigerian politicians have benefited from this. So yet again, the people in the communities are the ones who are getting screwed.
But isn't it dangerous? Last May, 200 people died after a pipeline near Lagos exploded. So what happens? Did people not realize that they shouldn't have lighted matches when they're doing this?
It's extremely dangerous stuff, and I tried to get close to it, but it is quite dangerous. I mean, it's the level of desperation in Nigeria is something that we really have to try to bear in mind. This is a country, despite being one of the world's biggest oil producers, where 57% of people live on less than a dollar a day. I mean, there's a daily struggle to survive, and you have 140 million people. It's an extraordinary place. Yes, people are very aware of the dangers, but they'll do whatever they need to do to get by. And it takes very little for one of these things to explode. I mean, the slightest spark can set off a huge explosion.
In Nigeria, oil production went from 5% to 80% of government revenue between 1965 and 1975. So what's been lost there? Is this another example of the Dutch disease?
Absolutely. And it's something we don't hear about very often because Nigeria's kind of violent political conflict is so much in the news in terms of this sort of oil conflict in the Delta. We often forget that actually Nigeria is also a classic, victim of the Dutch disease and the sort of rentier mentality. This is a country that was once a great producer of coffee, cocoa, palm oil, all kinds of things. And a lot of that's just really gone into decline since the oil.
Even a couple of Nobel Prize winners.
Absolutely.
You spoke to Chris Finlayson, chair of Shell's Africa Division in Nigeria, about a report Shell had commissioned that had been leaked to the press. And that report suggested that Shell was losing its social license to operate in Nigeria. What do you mean by social license?
This is extraordinary stuff. I mean, yeah, Shell commissioned this report that told them that basically they'd have to leave by 2008 if things didn't turn around. And this, I mean, just this report when it was leaked out, it spiked the price of oil because think about Shell is one of the world's largest oil companies. It also produces about half of Nigeria's oil. This for Shell to leave Nigeria. Anyone who's listening who thinks a lot of this stuff is happening halfway around the world and so on, you would see the price of oil skyrocket like we've never seen it before if oil companies have to bail out of Nigeria. So the news that it might even be a possibility was a big deal when it came out. And frankly, things have just got worse since then. I mean, so it's really hard to see how some of these oil companies... Look, Shell and Chevron have both evacuated hundreds of staff in the last few months. Now they're just down to essential personnel. A couple of weeks ago, the British High Commission in Lagos said that all Brits should leave the Delta. The Americans have been putting out similar warnings. It is a very dangerous place to operate now for an oil company, and yet this is the world's seventh largest producer of oil. So it's really hard to see. Something's got to give.
We got an email from a listener from Norway who writes, although I realize that it may be harder in Africa, they probably need to do what Norway did with the petroleum fund. There's a rule about how high a percentage of the fund can be used each year. Granted, there is a huge populist right-wing party and minor leftist parties that are against this limit on spending of oil money, but the rest of the parties have realized that it is better to save for the future and prevent overheating of the economy.
Norway is probably the only example of a country that really managed to make oil work for it, fundamentally. And
Britain didn't either.
Not in the same... Well, Britain's economy is much more diverse. I mean, it wasn't built on oil the way that Norway's was. But, you know, Norway was very enlightened in putting together this fund and so on. But again, this is a mature democracy and so on with a lot of institutions. This has been tried in Africa. This is what I would say to the listener. This was tried in Chad, and it was a catastrophic failure, frankly. It's being tried now in smaller countries, Sao Tome. And the jury is still out. I'm not sure Norway's experience translates as well to Africa, frankly, to countries that don't have the kind of capacity or the mature democratic institutions in Norway.
How many of the African countries are OPEC members?
In terms of sub-Saharan Africa, which is where I focus on for the book, now two. Initially one, Nigeria, but Angola has just joined in the last couple of months. It's the first new member of OPEC in over 30 years, and it's quite significant that it is an African country. We haven't really talked about Angola, but this is a really big up-and-coming player. It's rapidly catching up with Nigeria as a producer, and it's all offshore oil, and it's a really hot destination for the oil industry.
That's hard. Because the civil war is over.
Civil war's over now, 5 years ago. It's an unbelievable booming place. It's really hard to get a flight in there. It's one of them. It's probably the most expensive place on earth. It's extraordinary. I mean, you pay $30 for a plate of breakfast.
You know, again, I mean, the Dutch disease? Is that what?
Yeah, well, it's also partly because of the Civil War. The country was so decimated that everything is imported. I mean, the country doesn't even have a functioning taxi system. You know, I mean, it's really it's a place that, you know, really hard to get a flight in from Johannesburg or Lisbon or anywhere else. The Chinese are flooding in. Everyone's flooding in. You have these luxury apartment buildings going up. And it is also one of the poorest places on earth. You know, it's an incredible place.
John Gasvinian's book is Untapped, The Scramble for Africa's Oil. It's published by Harcourt. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.